The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Weekend has come and gone. At least that's what they say. I didn't notice a weekend. We got a great guest this first hour tonight, and then two more thereafter, as we always try to present to you every night. The guest tonight in our first hour is Donald Jeffries. He has crafted a book that I'm really looking forward to hearing about. And when you read some of the reviews on Amazon, for example, they're very riveting. Very compelling, very intriguing. This is maybe the book that we all need to read. Survival of the Richest: How the Corruption of the Marketplace and the Disparity of Wealth Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All. Wow. Here are a few reviews. Inequality doesn't just happen. It is created by the deliberate actions or inactions of the power elite. Read how they do it in Survival of the Richest. Donald Jeffries' Survival of the Richest lays out a roadmap of just how the rich play the money game at the expense of all the rest of us. Donald Jeffries is the rarest of historians, a truth teller about the crimes of the ruling class. I could go on. There are a whole bunch of them here. You can check it out on Amazon. But there's no question that all of us, except that 1% or maybe even less, are being looted, financially raped, scavenged. We are indentured servants to a class of people that are not normal. They are monstrous in their greed, and we are paying the price. And I don't know what can be done about it. Donald, welcome to the program. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for having me, Jeff.
My pleasure. Is it too late?
Too late to change the tide? Well, that's a good question. Since I've written my book, I have so many statistics in the book, and readers may hopefully don't get overwhelmed by the numbers. I mean, they're just mind-boggling. But
that's called proof. That's all right.
Yeah, exactly. Since the book has been written, though, just recently, the mainstream media was reporting that half of America now, the same 50% that has less than 1% of the collective wealth, that's half the country,
right,
is making less than $27,000 a year. And that's become my new talking point, because I don't see how you can have a first world country when you have half of your population that has essentially nothing. And so I think that...
Yeah. That's a point. That is an absolutely profoundly important point, and it has to do with the term first world. We are headed through immigration, through financial enslavement and impoverishment, to second world status. There's no question. You're right. That's a real key statement you made there, and I'm glad you made it. I don't know how, with a straight face or an honest demeanor, I can tell anyone anymore, vote, we'll change it. I'm sorry. It doesn't work for me. I won't lie to people. I think when I said, is it too late? I meant the greed that is running this country will die and destroy all of us before it will ever relinquish its grasp. That's my view. Tell me more.
Yeah, and I think that was the appeal of Donald Trump, is that he was, you know, a lot of us thought, well, perhaps maybe this guy was playing the game all these years, and the only kind of outsider in or the way our system is rigged, as he often pointed out, the only kind of outsider we're ever likely to get would be a kind of a rogue billionaire, a Ross Perot or a Donald Trump type. And he, you know, in between all his kind of lunatic statements and crazy stuff about wanting to give the police more power and so forth, but he also said some really revolutionary things. He called out the phony unemployment rate. He's the first one really to talk about how awful these trade deals are, and that's certainly contributed significantly to the mess we're in. But he made immigration his key issue, and that's what really got my attention. And that's what differentiates me from a lot of leftists. A lot of leftists love everything about my book, Survival of the Richest, but they don't know how to deal with the immigration issue. And as you mentioned with immigration, I keep telling people, you have 50% of the country that has nothing. You keep bringing more poor people into the country. Where are they entering? They're entering the absolute bottom of that ladder.
That's right.
So they're making that 50% grow and grow. So in another, you know, if nothing happens with DACA, or if we don't have deportations and get a grip on our border security finally, then you're going to, you know, may have 60, 70%. Within a decade or so that have nothing, because all those poor people are coming here, and they're poorer than anyone we have, and we have a lot of poor people. So
and that's not first world.
No, no. And it's beginning to resemble a third world banana republic type of thing. And
here's,
certainly,
excuse me, Don, I got to say this.
Sure.
Here's the greatest irony. Somehow this government, state, local, federal, continues to give most of these immigrants everything that the cream of the cream of our country's productiveness, our heritage, our society, our way of life. Give them everything. You know the routine: for education, medicine, food, shelter, cars, spending money. It doesn't matter. They're getting everything. And Americans are going without. How in the hell can that be? Where did Donald Trump go, if he ever was really there, and how were we deceived so thoroughly?
Well, I think it had been so long since, well, really never. We had never heard a mainstream party candidate talk about these things. And I couldn't believe my ears sometimes. I thought, you know, I expected him to say 9/11 was an inside job in one of his speeches. But obviously he's been incredibly disappointing. And, you know, I guess we were fooled. But
boy, that's the understatement of the year. I really, honest to God, I've never seen anyone reverse more vows, more promises, more pledges. And we have only two choices here. Was it a con job for a year and a half, telling us what we wanted to hear, very carefully orchestrated, knowing what buttons to push within us as a collective? Or, after he was elected, did somebody sit him down and explain the rules of the game to him? I don't know which.
Yeah.
I really don't.
Yeah, well, it's hard to say, and I don't know, you know, if it matters that much if it turns to business as usual, which
kinda,
well, it is.
Doesn't
but you
matter.
Made, but you made the key point again about immigration. I think the reason why we see immigrants getting well, at the same time, Americans have such a strange way. It's almost doublethink the way they look at they love to beat up on the American poor and say get a job and, you know, let's have more welfare reforms like under Bill Clinton, where, you know, fewer people get less benefits now for a shorter period of time, thanks to his reforms. And people even want to cut that, the Paul Ryans of the world. But on the other hand, they want to keep they want to keep giving every benefit they possibly can to immigrants, including illegal immigrants. And I think it's very obvious. It's because they represent what they want most in the world, which is the cheapest labor possible. And I believe, in my mind, that these people really would love to bring back slavery more than anything. They would love to, and I don't mean African-American slavery. I mean, they want slaves. They want to have people working for them for nothing.
Well, that minimum wage is enslavement. It basically is. You can't survive. And then the other end of the enslavement stick is something called student loans. Lifetime indentured slavery to a system that will never give them a break. That we've lost our way and then some. It's looking damn bad.
The average student loan is $32,000 a year. Now, what they've done is they've restructured. So those people haven't been, and I talk to older people all the time, and they have no idea how the job market has changed in the last 15, 20 years.
What job market?
Exactly. Where now, you know, what the new normal is, and I refer to the new normal a lot in my book because there's so many new normals, and none of them are improvements, where the average person now, a young kid or whatever, looking for a job, they want to get a job at a Kmart or some low-paid retail job. They have to apply online. It's an arduous process, sometimes involves a 100 to 200 question test, which is usually psychological in nature. These are for the lowest paid jobs imaginable.
Right.
You know, not that long ago, you could walk into these stores and get a job off the street. You didn't need a resume. What kind of resume do you need to work at a place like that? This is the reality there. And a lot of college students have to settle for these kind of jobs or jobs that are slightly above that, which as recently as a decade ago didn't require a college degree. But now, because these students are so mired in debt, they figured they have to throw them a crumb. So they give them a crappy job that used to go to high school students now, because now they require a degree. And the people that don't have college degrees, I guess they're just completely out of luck. But again, they're looking for that cheap labor, and they use the illegal immigrants are so important to the new normal, the way things are structured, is because they beat Americans over the head with this mantra, they're just doing the jobs America won't do. I mean, Americans won't do. I tell people all the time, do you think we didn't used to cut our lawns? We didn't used to do our landscaping? How do you think this stuff got done?
It's a lie. It's a cop. It's a lie. Of course we'll do the work.
Just we didn't do it for slave labor. And people, you know, another point in my book, I try to point out things I don't think anyone's looking at. In fact, I tried Googling a couple times to try out more information about this subject, and no one apparently but me is looking into this. But I'm looking at, like, for instance, what certain jobs paid. I'll give you a perfect example of this. Back in the early 80s, I know someone personally who was a cashier at Safeway, you know, a big grocery store chain. He was making $17 an hour,
right,
part-time. In the early 80s. That same job today, you'll start at less than $10 an hour.
Right.
If you took what he was making, if you calculated in the early 80s the purchasing power he had, a cashier at Safeway today would have to be paid over $112,000 a year. Can you imagine that? That's the purchasing power he had.
$17 an hour was
$35,000 a year. Yeah.
No, it was survivable. It was substantial. I'm not sure if they had unions then or what the reason is, but this the diminution in wages is blinding. Go ahead.
They didn't have a strong union, and that's part of the reason that things like Reagan. I study Reagan, I realize what it, I mean. And I don't think Reagan himself, because he was a figurehead, but his era really had a dramatic impact on so many things. From the 1986 Immigration Reform Act, which granted amnesty to millions and probably closed the door really on getting a handle on something on an issue like that when it could have been resolved. His Tax Reform Act of 1986, the same kind of thing, where he got rid of all the deductions that working class and poor had depended on forever, as far as you couldn't write off consumer credit anymore. The only thing they kept on there was mortgage interest, but interest for car loans and credit cards and other kinds of loans could no longer be written off. But when he stood up to the air traffic controller strike, and so many blue-collar workers mindlessly cheered him. He really, whatever, if that was a symbolic gesture, I don't know, but you can delineate from that point on. That's when the unions in America started to crumble. They no longer exist to any meaningful degree, and I think it's no accident that you can look at about that time when wages starting to go down in effective terms, because even jobs that weren't union jobs, another example I'll give you is Circuit City. Big chain that used to exist back then. In the mid-80s, salesmen were getting commission along with salary at Circuit Cities. They were making $30,000 to $35,000 in the mid-80s. Again, you're talking about $100,000 plus a year in today's term. They eventually stopped paying the commission. They started making 10 bucks an hour or whatever. That's the kind of reality. And there's so many more examples, I'm sure, that were out there. I have to research further, but you know, apparently no one else is researching, because I search and search and search, and I can't find too much anecdotal evidence about it. But those are the things I remember myself. And if you talk to people now, they just give you that blank look. But it's, you know, how could, for instance, how could a Safeway afford to pay someone that kind of salary back then? And they can't do it now. Well, it's because apparently back then their CEO was probably just called president back then. They didn't have the cool term of CEO then. Wasn't making, you know, $40, $50 million a year, giving himself, you know, a $10 million Christmas bonus, and to his other fellow executive vice presidents in charge of looking out the window, you know, making hundreds of thousands of dollars and getting huge bonuses just for agreeing to everything, right, every new cutback of employees. And this, you know, these, it's just such a disastrous now atmosphere throughout corporate America, and the entire thing seems to be predicated upon one thing, and that is greed is good.
Yeah.
And that,
oh, yeah,
what, you know, yeah, profit, all accounts is what kind of, how big is my bonus going to be? And the profits don't even count. Another thing people don't realize is after we bailed the banks out in 2008, I mean, they'll ridicule welfare people and poor people and say, we just give money, they'll run out and just do drugs and buy more alcohol. Well, these bankers were worse than any crack addicts you've ever seen. They ran off and took off for vacation spots around the world. They gave themselves such large bonuses that that year after we bailed them out, six of those nine banks gave out more in bonuses to their executives than they made in profits for their companies. What kind of business model is that? But that's, I mean, the Ayn Rand disciples that love, I mean, how do you explain that? That they said the marketplace will fix anything. Well, how does the marketplace give more money to management than the company itself is making? How can a business even sustain itself?
I agree. You know what else is going on? We have now walked fully into the light of a drugged and drug culture. I'm talking about legal pharmacological drugs. All you got to do is turn on the TV. What do you see? Back to back, endless procession of pharmacological advertisements. 60-second spots, 30-second spots. If the 60s are there, 45 of them are hyper-fast talk, warning about side effects, okay? 15 seconds of it are showing smiling, happy people. For some reason, they're happy, they're blissful, they're there, they're recovered. You know who did that? You know who deregulated all that and allowed the pharmaceuticals
that
to...
Was that under Clinton, too? I can't...
No, Reagan. Reagan.
Hello?
Reagan.
Hello?
Yeah, it was Ronald Reagan.
Hello?
I'm here. I don't know why you can't hear me.
Hello?
Okay. Todd, I don't know what... Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I'm back.
You there, Don?
Yeah, okay. Can you hear?
Yeah.
You know?
All right, we got you. Ronald Reagan did that.
Yeah, okay, yeah, and it's, isn't it amazing? And that's, and TV is almost, I mean, TV has always been unwatchable for, at least for the last, you know, since maybe the 70s, but...
Well, it's programming, it's mind control, no more, no less. Used to pretend to be entertainment, no more.
Well, they're so, and now that I'm getting older myself, I mean, it's unbearable to watch. It's just one, you know, and the side effects of all these awful pharmaceuticals. I mean,
they're
I don't
often,
take any of them.
They're often deadly. That's no joke. We are literally living in a culture of pharmacological induced early death, misery, suffering, compound interreactions with varying medications that can cause catastrophic results at any time. Nobody knows. Nobody understands. They just stare blankly at this goddamn thing, and they don't get it. They won't get it. They're not allowed to get it. And they're also being anesthetized with everything from chemtrails to fluoride to GMOs, especially GMOs, in their food, and I think also EMF through the cell phone grid and other electromagnetic businesses that are bombing us with cell phone EMF type radiation around the clock. That's being used. That also the electric grid, which is in your home, every wire in your house, they can put frequencies on that which control. We are electrical beings. There's a frequency for everything, and they know it. They know it. So we don't have much of a chance. We've got 100 million Americans still out of work, okay? And as you pointed out, those people who do get jobs get what kind of jobs? 11, 12 bucks an hour?
Right.
Purchasing power next to zero? Here, let me tell you another good one I heard today. Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world now, Amazon, He picked the right word for the company, didn't he? Amazon. It's it. He is apparently in, I don't know what stage, but in discussions with, and I got the impression that it's going to happen, acquisition, buying of the entire chain of 1,500 Target stores.
Oh, wow.
Now, why is he doing that? You say, wow, this guy is going to have retail on every corner. What I understand is he's thinking of turning them all into a ready-made national grid of Amazon delivery stations. These are going to be Amazon warehouses in your town, and they'll use their little drones, and they'll send all their little goodies right to your house. They'll have their own people, their own drivers. It's the guy is going to double his wealth. So what the best thing he could do would be to buy a chain like Target, represented coast to coast, still on its feet, has a good reputation. He doesn't care, though. He wants the physical locations to wage this kind of war against all of us. He's going to do it. He's going to do it.
And beyond the Orwellian overtones of that, spying on people and so forth, we know Jeff Bezos, for instance, pays his Amazon workers, especially in their – we have lots of stories. I've been sharing them on Facebook about how he basically watches every movement of his workers in the warehouse. For Christmas, while I'm sure he probably got a – who knows what kind of $50 million bonus or whatever he got for Christmas himself and his top executives.
Now, he should have got it for Hanukkah, not Christmas.
Well, there you go. Exactly. The holidays. I'm sorry. They're during the holiday season. I believe the Amazon workers got two pieces of chocolate during their 8-hour
shift.
Is
that what it was?
That's
he
what
gave
it was.
Them two. Talk about
two
throwing
pieces.
Throwing some dog crap at your employees.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
an
and
insult.
That,
what an insult.
Exactly, and that's the – and Bezos represents – it's a perfect example. And I analyze in Survival of the Riches. I go into the backgrounds of these people, and what I point out is I said, look, you know, nobody minds people being rich, but there's got to be a reason why they're rich. For instance, if someone like Bezos or Bill Gates or Buffett or any of these guys had discovered a cure for cancer, although, you know, we know, obviously, what cancer really is, but if they came up with some magic pill where no one would ever get cancer again, okay, then he's worth all the money you can bestow on him. If they came up with some kind of technology single-handedly to extend life, you know, double, triple what it is now, which it probably really should be if we were really making any progress in that area. But you don't see that. These people don't seem to be, you know, notorious for anything other than they're really good at making money. They're good at investing.
Right.
They're good at inheriting. Most of them are real good at inheriting things. And you had the myths like Bill Gates coming from a middle-class family. His father was president of Planned Parenthood. His grandfather was a bank president. His mother was sitting on the boards of directors of banks and big companies back in the 1950s.
Typical middle-class family.
Yeah, exactly. But this is the myth we're sold. Bill Gates was middle class. I mean,
unreal.
Warren Buffett's
I know.
Father.
It's all a lie.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all a lie.
It is.
Daniel, it's all a lie. It's sad to say, but it is. And I'm becoming more concerned all the time about the next two generations and their ability to discern lies. They're growing up with them. How are they going to discern from lies and reality? Because their reality is the reality of the lie. It's not ours. It's theirs. We can't expect them to understand things the way we do. They haven't experienced the moral constraints, boundaries, common sense, decency that we had when we were kids. Their world is different. They don't understand our language. Stand by. We'll be right back with Donald Jeffries and his book. It's a knockout, Survival of the Richest, How the Corruption of the Marketplace and the Disparity of Wealth Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All. Donald Jeffries has done his homework and then some. This is a world that few people really understand anymore, the younger generations. I'm not knocking them. It's not their fault that they were dumbed down, and there are some awfully smart ones still left in the deck of cards out there. But they've done that on their own, or they've had extraordinary parents, and most were homeschooled. They weren't put into the government schools of mental indoctrination, mind control, social engineering, configuration, texturing, all the works that we know about and that are being done and exerted upon them. They don't have a chance. That's the issue. They look, they watch, they react, they drool, they eat, they sleep, they do drugs, they have sex. They look for a job. They're underpaid. They're impoverished. They have no future. They know it. So what are their options? Who gives a shit? Excuse my French. That's what I hear out in the streets. I hear them say that. Exactly that. They don't care. How do you instill and inculcate and somehow energize these people with care when they know they've got no future? They're being dragged down into third world status as we speak. That Jeff Bezos of the world and all the rest of them, that is their plan, their template, their goal. Ever since 1913, when the central banking system was approved by a corrupt, blackmailed, and bribed Congress, we've been finished. And it's been downhill ever since. And that's where we're going. Now, I really do salute Donald for writing about this because he's analyzed the problem. And if only all these younger people would read this book, they might at least get up in the morning and scratch their head a little differently. Say, well, maybe there's something out there that I can do to at least better myself and my loved ones and my family. It's not easy. Anyway, Donald, go ahead. Where are we?
Well, yeah, and I think one of the many memorable things Ross Perot said back during his first presidential run that struck me was he said, if we didn't change direction, the course we were going in this country, the next generation, you know, our children were going to be the first generation of Americans to have a lower standard of living than us.
Yeah. And now shorter lives.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And that's unquestionable. And so I know a lot of people make fun of the millennials. My children are millennials. And, you know, I think baby boomers have done really an awful job of running this country into the ground. And they've sold out the future for these kids who, as you noted, I mean, right. 50 years ago, you know, we like to say the old terms, like say, oh, you know, we worked harder. No, we didn't. You know, 50, you know, when I was in 1960s up to the 1970s, any job, I mean, any job, gas station, you could work at, you could at least get an apartment. And any job, I knew lots of parents whose fathers worked in, you know, Montgomery Wards and Sears and stores that, you know, no longer exist, that were run out of business. And right. They just had they worked behind a counter. You know, the kind of retail now that we would either expect someone just to snuck over the border to do, or some teenager, and we wouldn't want to pay him anything. They paid enough of a wage, and they had real benefits where they could have owned a single-family home. They could drive a nice car.
Exactly.
Their wife never had to work.
Go back and look at some of the 50s. Go look at some of the 50s. Look at Ozzie and Harriet. Go look at a few programs, okay? Just go look at some of those early television sitcoms and if you want to get a real idea of what things were like then. And what Donald is saying is exactly right. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it was, you know, of course we know that underneath the surface there was a lot of dysfunction and lots of awful things going on. It wasn't perfect, but the overall economic picture was so much better. And that was really the last time. I mean, that's why I say, you know, when I wrote Hidden History, my first book, I started with the JFK assassination. I think that's kind of when that era ended. And I believe from that point on,
it ended with a crash.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Ended with a crash. And since that point, if you were looking at a graph, November 22nd, 1963, you'd see like a steady downward line up to that point. Whereas in the 1950s,
a steady upward line of the looting of the future of this country, physical and spiritual.
Yeah. Well, there's been a massive transfer of wealth upwards, and that's the thing people don't realize. And you mentioned greed earlier. You know, one of my heroes is Huey Long, and I devote a chapter.
Oh, wonderful
to Huey
man! God, a great man.
Yeah, and I devote a whole chapter to him, and I've been able to communicate with his great granddaughter, who's continuing his work. So, he's my hero, and he said so many great things. But I think he hit the nail on the head when we tried to get behind what is the motive for this greed. He said, you know, it's not enough for people to to be wealthy, to have money. They also have to know you don't have it. And I think that's the mindset, is it's not enough for these people to have everything. They get off in some
bizarre... That's the flip side of greed. That's the evil that runs it.
Yeah. You exactly. And Huey Long recognized that kind of stuff. And of course, that's why they assassinated him. And after he As we predicted, he would be assassinated for a long time. But God knows what Huey Long would think about today's world. He probably wouldn't even believe it because he was advocating.
He'd move to Costa Rica and hide.
There you go. Well, he was advocating a 30, 20-hour, even 20-hour work week back in the 1930s in the midst of the Great Depression. And now we're barely clinging to the 40-hour work. About the only good thing that came out of the New Deal was a really watered-down version of what Huey Long and other really far-left people wanted, because they were looking, again, for 30-hour, maybe 20-hour work week, 2 months off every year for workers, so forth. Real workers' rights. But the National, I think, Fair Labor Relations Act or something in 1938, that gave us the 40-hour work week. It gave us a concept of overtime, sick leave, things that no workers had. Most people don't realize. My grandfather, for instance, was like a security guard. He worked 12 hours a day, 6 to 6, and 365 days a year. He got to come home on Christmas Day to eat lunch with his family. That was not a rarity in those days. People don't realize that. And, you dropped dead on the job, basically. You got sick, that's too bad. They hired somebody else. So that's why you can't have this kind of Wild West mentality, because that's what happens. That's why now you have, and I have a lot of information in the book on how debtors' prisons are coming back, child labor is coming back. And we already know there are 30 million slaves around the world today, which makes it really ironic that we continue to hear so much about the Civil War era when there are 30 million slaves in the world today, 10 million in India, of all places. And India, we know, is taking over the IT industry with the deadly H-1B visa worker program, which is another aspect of immigration that Trump claimed he was going to end and hasn't. And for some reason, I don't hear any liberals or anyone wanting to boycott India over their 10 million slaves today, but they'll still talk about slavery 150 years ago in this country.
Unfortunately, the liberals define the new. Well, they're nuts. I don't know what the hell they think they're doing. They're more than hypocrites. They're just nothing about them is real. They don't understand. I don't think they understand reality anymore as a group.
And they're, not only are there no civil libertarians left, so they don't care, but they want to get people fired now, and they want to take away rights instead of fighting for them. But
every law passed takes away something.
Exactly. And people have been realize how much personal freedom we had in like the 1970s. As we do now.
Even then. Absolutely. I think it was almost double. I honestly do.
I tell people how I used to be able to smoke cigarettes everywhere. You could walk in a grocery store and flick your cigarette on the ground. I mean, it's like, they go, what? Yeah, I mean, you could, but and I'm not saying that's a good thing.
No, we're being regulated into oblivion.
Yeah,
it's post-Orwellian. It's way past.
It really is, but people don't seem to realize that. And they, for instance, what happened to big labor? And again, we look at the reason why, again, these wages and benefits have been eradicated largely through the death of unions and because of the impact of immigration. Well, the left, which used to live, being an expert on the Kennedys and writing about the Kennedys so much, I know how often, just those political intrigues of the Democratic parties back in the 60s and into the 70s, where they would fight for the endorsement of George Meany or Walter Ruther, or one of these big labor leaders.
They would. Absolutely.
Who's the big labor leader now? There is no big labor because they can't have it, because then they would have to address the impact of immigration, and they won't do it because that's a voting constituency they're trying to get. Even if they're not citizens, they want them to vote. I mean, I keep saying, if you have the Jerry Brown types, Jerry Brown used to have some decent, positions on issues up through even the 90s. I don't know what happened to him, but he definitely is Governor Moonbeam now. But, he literally wants illegals to be able to vote. And I said, what is the point of American citizenship if you don't have to be a citizen to vote? I mean, I don't get that at all, but people, I think, because of political correctness, and I think that's why immigration is such a deadly issue and such a big part of survival of the richest, what I'm writing about, is because both the left and the right, really, it's important to both of them. The left, it's a potential voting block, and it's political correctness, so they can't go against it. And the right, it's cheap labor. It's something they can exploit to bring down their costs of doing business, so their profits go up and their bonuses get bigger. And, nobody, I'm trying to talk about it, but my friends on the left, they're just tone deaf on this.
Do you still have any?
Well, I'm losing. I lost a lot over Trump originally, but you see people for what they are, and it's just you have to be able to. I don't know why people can't see the big picture and what, Alex Jones, before he became, Trump cheerleader, used to talk about the left. He he popularized the left-right paradigm, and we all kind of know that. I mean, this left-right thing, where something like immigration, like a guy like Richard Lamb, who was a Democrat, he wrote a, I think, believe called the Immigration Time Bomb or something. He was very good on immigration. He was the last Democrat I know that was really good on immigration. And
who is it? I'm sorry, who is this?
Governor Richard Lamb, I believe he was in Colorado.
Oh, Lamb, Colorado.
Yeah, Lamb. Yeah, yeah. And but he was the last Democrat that I know of that talked about it in that way. But, you know, again, you talk about things like big labor and people just give you that blank look. Oh, yeah, like you said, I do remember this big labor. Well, what happened to
him? Maybe they could say Jimmy Hoffa, Teamsters, if you're lucky.
There you go. Yeah. And of course, we know, and that was the thing about the unions. We know how corrupt they were, and certainly they were in bed with the mafia, but their presence lifted wages and benefits, and even all the non-union jobs. I never worked for a union, but every job I ever had, I was making more money because just the threat of unions raised everyone's wages because they were trying to compete with what the union guys were getting. And people don't realize the kind of benefits. I was talking to my sisters the other day who are a lot older than me, and they were talking about one of our relatives and another neighbor of theirs. I know them both. They were just talking about what was not an unusual benefit for working class people not that long ago. Both of them, as part of their pension package, have free health insurance for life. Now, just imagine that. Now, that's unthinkable not to get, but how did those companies give those kind of benefits? And those are the kind of things
that was before they were looted. They're all out of money. They have no money.
Yep, the money went somewhere, and it went right to the top. And that's why any proposal, whether it's Bernie Sanders talking about a living wage or raising the minimum wage or anything like that, you have to address the issue. And this is why Huey Long is a real populist, which is what I consider myself as a populist, as opposed to a typical.
Well, labels have changed. Labels have changed a lot in the years gone by. Huey, his label now wouldn't apply to many. He was a different kind of a man. Here, get this one now. We talked about third world. San Francisco. The city by the bay, the jewel by the Golden Gate. NBC did a real investigative piece on it, studied 153 blocks of downtown San Francisco. Now, you talk about third world. In search of garbage, they found trash littering every single block. They also found 41 blocks with hypodermic needles all over the place, on the street, all over. 96 blocks with piles of feces and urine puddles or stains. Yeah. See, and these are not American citizens doing this. These are immigrants. Right. These are immigrants. Make no mistake about it. These people are bringing their fourth and fifth world ethos with them here. The government knows it. The government will not stop the United Nations importation of Somalians and Arabs from the Middle East. They will not do it, even though they know that their very religion, if they're religious at all, calls for our deaths. They're importing our own executioners who crap in the streets, piss in the streets, do anything they want. They don't work. They have no ethic to try and assimilate in this country at all. They want us dead. This is a direct attack on America to destroy it and bring it down to third world. That's what we're facing. No one in this Congress will deal with that. They're all crooks, criminals, phonies, frauds, liars, cheats. Go ahead.
Yeah, and that lack of assimilation is planned. They wanted
you
that.
Bet
way.
It is. I mean, it
wasn't the Hispanics that decided to put up Spanish signs or print every ballot or every directive in Spanish too. Those were all white leaders that did that. Someone made a decision, and again, up until this,
someone made a decision. You got it.
Yeah. And why would they do that? Well, let's look at it this way. It causes more fractionalization, which is apparently what our leaders want. They want us out at each other's throats. They don't want people to be able to communicate with each other. Then we might understand each other.
Divide, chaos, and conquer.
Divide and conquer. Yeah. That's right. Order out of chaos. And they don't. And it also serves their purposes. The immigrants don't gain from this either, because if they never learn the language, it serves to keep them in their place, to keep them on the bottom, to keep them desperately poor, which is what they want. It says, but they don't want to lift them up. They want to drag us down to that level and us to be satisfied with it. And they use their presence to say, well, look, you know, they're happy. Look at them. They're happy. You know, they're happy. Well, why can't you be content? How do they live? Instead, not understanding the desperate circumstances they're coming from. If they're coming from a mud hut,
right.
Yeah, a little apartment with air conditioning and cable TV probably seems really cool.
Well, it's like they died. It's like they died and went to heaven. Look, the bottom line is the world is not equal. All men and all women are not created equal. They do not live in equal societies. They need to stay where they are from. They don't need to come here. Everybody with a brain who can engage in linear, progressive, logical thought knows this. And yet the decision has been made to inject these people into our culture and destroy it. We are being destroyed. I don't know how else to phrase it. I've been telling people this for years.
Well, I mean, I can certainly understand that, but even not even going to that extent, it's always a simple matter of numbers. I mean, we don't have the jobs, we don't have the resources for the people in this country. So it wouldn't matter if they were purple people from Mars.
No chance.
It's impossible. We don't have the resources, the jobs. The last thing any sane leadership would do would be to bring more people into the country, especially poor people that have nothing. That's just absolute insanity.
Daniel, they won't even use the toilets when they're given them. Okay? Yep. They don't.
Well, it's
just their culture. I'm not condemning them. I'm just saying that's what it is. It doesn't fit here.
Right. You get the cultural clashes. And again, it all serves to keep all these things keep to serve the people. You talked about the Federal Reserve and the banking system. It keeps the people to keep them distracted. If they're arguing with or they're seeing somebody peeing in the street, or they're worrying about trying to communicate with them at a convenience store or whatever, it frustrates them. And that's what they see. They don't have time to think about, you know, the fractional lending system and how it's counterfeit, it's legal counterfeiting. I try to tell people, and they're just too distracted to try to understand it.
We're talking about building a wall. We don't need to build a wall. Oh, we simply need to enforce the laws we have. Send these people back home. Let them apply through the front door. If they can pass, then they can come in. We have to have rules. When we give up control of our borders and our immigration policy like we have, we no longer really have the right to call ourselves a first world nation. We're not. We're turning into a garbage pit. And no one seems to be talking about this, especially in the controlled media, which again, deregulated by the Clintons, used to be the tens of thousands of owners of newspapers, radio, AM and FM, radio stations, TV stations, you name it. Six corporations control over 95% of the media in this country. And if you folks don't think we are all being conned continually, you do or you wouldn't be listening to this program. I got the best audience in talk radio here. I'm very proud of them. They are so smart. They get it. And they know. And they really appreciate what you've done. We just have a couple of minutes left. Daniel, what do you want to talk about in that 2 minutes?
Well, I mean, again, I think when you talk about that, I think in Trump's case, he's basically become like Goldstein in Orwell's 1984, where he's kind of a figure where we're doing everything but the two-minute hate on him, where he's become a symbolic figure. And for instance, what he tried to do with immigration, he first was attacked when he simply pointed out that he met with the poor mother of the woman in San Francisco, I believe, that had been killed by an illegal immigrant that had been deported 8 times or something, and he was jumped on for that. And I'm thinking,
Kate Steinle.
This is the kind of political correctness that has poisoned the political debate, because if you can't even be opposed to murderers just because they are illegal immigrants, somehow that
political correctness is a malignancy that has gotten into this country again through the media, which promulgates it nonstop. It is a lie. It's a fraud. It's designed again to take down honest debate, discussion, and common sense. And it works. It works.
It
makes
certainly
me sick.
Doesn't. And it just the because of all this, it distracts, like the point that obviously I'm trying to make in Survival of the Richest, and my logical base should be that left. But again, the political correctness makes them not see a large chunk of what I'm talking about. But the overriding issue, I think, is that, again, we have that kind of the old cantered that, you know, you don't talk about religion and politics around the table. And there's a lot of people throw money in there, too. Nobody wants to talk about money and how much money various people have. Well, when you have so few people that have so much, much. And, you know, about 80% of us are living paycheck to paycheck, the ones that have jobs. It's just, you can't have a forward work. You have to have people be able to buy whatever few products you're still making, even though you've outsourced your industry offshore.
Where is the disposable income? What stats do you have on that? How many? The actual average family is, what, $25,000 in credit card debt minimum. That was three, four years ago.
Yeah, and I think it's 60 or 70%. The statistics change yearly every few months, and they get worse. Don't have $500 in savings. So you're right, disposable income, they literally have nothing because they obviously have to save a tiny bit if they have a sudden illness, a car repair, any of, you know, millions of things that could happen. Now, house, home repair, any kind of things that's just part of life. Most people don't have savings for that. They don't have anything for a rainy day, the old expression. So there is no disposable income, and the only way they can participate in society is to use those credit cards, which, of course, gets them mired in debt and gets their makes their credit rating go, which credit rating is tied to everything now.
Right, and I would urge all of you out there, especially you heads of household, parents, do not allow your children to get student loans unless you want to throw the rest of their lives away. They will never pay them off. Ever. Was it $35,000 on the average?
It's like 30, yeah, close to that. Right? And it's
that's just, the average.
Yeah, that's the average. And just to think of it, and again, it's because of the elitist nature. Most people don't realize, again, only 3%. There is no meritocracy in America, and there's no upward mobility. Only 3% of the people that come from the bottom quarter income-wise of Americans go to the top 146 colleges. Those are the colleges where if you go to, you know, Ivy League, something like that, you're going to be set. You get a degree from there, it's way different than getting a degree at your local college.
Oh, yeah,
but
of course.
No one from, only the people at the top go to those schools, so it perpetuates themselves. You have an aristocracy at the top that keeps, you know, perpetuate the children and the grandchildren of these people go on and they take the new jobs, their friends do and so forth, and there's not the Thomas Jefferson dreamed of a meritocracy. We don't have a meritocracy, and you can't with the kind of disparity of wealth we have.
Oh, my. Well, it's Daniel, pitch the book one more time. Tell them where to get it.
You can get it, obviously, at Amazon, Jeff Bezos' place. It's in most Barnes & Noble stores. It's published by Skyhorse Publishing, so you can get it from the publisher. You Google it, you can find it anywhere. It's Survival of the Richest. And, again, people can also, they can come to my blog. I write regularly. My blog's called Keep It Unreal. It's donaldjeffries.wordpress.com.
Well, I really am honored to have you on the program. I'd like to have you come back again in a bit, and just let me know when you're ready, and we'll do it. Great, great discussion. Thank you very much for doing that book.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
All right, there you go. And the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Be right back.